This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture. And today I'm here with Ricky Rodriguez, the author of A Kiss Across the Ocean, Transatlantic Intimacies of British Post-Punk and U.S. Latinidad.
Can you start by talking a little bit about how this book came to be and why you decided to sort of write about British post-punk and your relationship with it?
Sure. So there are a number of routes that led to this book. Initially, I was working on a second book, which was much more academic oriented, which isn't to say that this one isn't, but it has a different shape and character, which I'll talk about in a bit. But the impetus really to start this project was a call for papers for a symposium on the British electro duo Pet Shop Boys. And the symposium was scheduled to take place at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And I had just recently met a couple of friends, a couple of guys who became friends through a friend of ours who lives in LA and was visiting Chicago. And I was living in Chicago at the time. And so we hit it off, and they told me, well, if you're ever in Scotland, let us know. And I also have a cousin who lives in Glasgow. So it was, you know, really exciting to see that call for papers, because not only would I have the chance to go to Scotland for the first time, but also to present on one of my favorite music artists. And fortunately, my proposal was accepted, and I delivered a paper at the symposium on the Pet Shop Boys song Domino Dancing and the music video and the controversy that it caused when it was initially released. The video was banned from MTV. The song was seen as the downfall of the Pet Shop Boys imperial phase, as singer Neil Tennant called it. And so it didn't chart as high. And a lot of people speculated it was because it had outright flirted with a Latin sound. And it had always been one of my favorite songs, because the way that it does incorporate elements of Latin freestyle, which was popular in the 1980s. So, you know, I kind of had the chance to present that, and I got a lot of really great reception on the paper, and I didn't know where it was going to lead. Initially, the conference organizers had promised to edit an anthology, which never came to fruition. And then a few weeks later, I gave a talk at a conference on a panel focused on Susie and the Banshees. And that was another opportunity to write about a band that I had loved and admired since I was a teenager. And so there are these two papers that I delivered that I thought could maybe develop into something eventually. And so fast forward a few years to the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, and of course, you know, you're familiar with this, we all went into lockdown. And although we were doing most of our work online, there was a little bit more time for introspection and the need to kind of occupy yourself with things. And I personally, I was on the brink of falling into somewhat of a depression, as was the case for a lot of people. And so I decided to throw myself into my writing. But the book project that I had been working on had just not really interested me anymore. So I kind of put that on the back burner and thought about maybe putting, or pulling together these two papers that I delivered and turning it into a book project. And soon enough, it just started making sense. And interestingly, the Susie and the Banshees chapter is the first chapter in the book, and the Pet Shop Boys chapter is the last chapter. And they're kind of seen as, I think in terms of popular music, polar opposites. Susie and the Banshees being a band that develops from the early British punk movement, and the Pet Shop Boys, who probably at first blush don't seem anything like punk, and yet there are parallels that you can draw between them. And I thought, this could be something. And so I just started thinking about the various ways that Latino culture influenced British musicians, because at the time there was a lot of conversation about how, Latinos were gravitating towards artists like Morrissey, the former lead singer of the Smiths, and so much ink had been spilled writing about, what that phenomenon was about, and people trying to, decode or unlock the mystery of that. And it just seemed natural to me that there was this huge fan base, given the fact that, I grew up in Southern California, being of Mexican American heritage, and a lot of my friends were also into this music at that time. And so I'd been following these artists for forever. But I also wanted to put a spin on it and not talk about Latino fandom, but also to think about the mutual influences that were at play with respect to Latino audiences and British musicians. And so, it kind of started collecting the pieces of the puzzle and seeing how these influences, were, quite expansive and so it was just kind of unlocking, these different examples by digging into the magazines that I'd been reading since I was a teenager, Smash Hits, the British version of the magazine, and Star Hits, the US version, newspapers like New Musical Express, Record Mirror. And, of course, having, been a tenured professor who had a steady source of income now, unlike my teenage years where it was kind of like saving lunch money in order to buy a record or asking my parents if I could buy a magazine when we went grocery shopping, I could locate materials that I didn't have access to at the time. And so in many ways, aside from traveling to the UK and doing a little bit of archival work in the British Library, I was able to, turn to eBay as my record store magazine stand where I could collect a lot of these periodicals that had, fallen between my fingers as a teenager that I either couldn't locate or couldn't afford. So yeah, it was just a process of amassing all of this material, creating an archive, and then also, creating an argument which is about that mutual influence. And also, I'm probably talking way too much, Rebecca. I'll just say this: initially, it started out as more of an academic book. I was trying not to include myself in the narrative, even though I had been a huge fan of these bands. But I was part of a writing group where one of my colleagues, who's a creative writer, identified a personal anecdote in one of the footnotes, and he said, "This needs to be in the body of the text." And I told him, "I can't do that because it would kind of delegitimate the study as, an academic study." And I felt like, he gave me a license to do that. And once I did, it just opened a floodgate for me to kind of incorporate my own personal experience alongside writing about this musical genre or this cultural phenomenon in a way that was both scholarly as well as personal. And just kind of feeling my way around by way of writing, I think I was able to kind of combine those two approaches, and the end result is this book.
I will agree with your colleague that I think it's, I loved that personal connection, right? And it might be that you and I are very close in age, right? Like, and had some similar musical like background tastes. And so I think like, I was like, oh, I remember that. I remember that when that came out, or, you know, that tour or those kind, like, so I love that personal connection. It was wonderful. And I will
Thank you.
all, yeah. And I will say, like, I appreciate, as a gigantic Smiths fan and a like recovering Morrissey fan, I will say that's the best
Yeah.
way to say it.
I love
Like,
it.
right, like it's hard. It's, you know, it's yeah. And I interviewed Melissa Hidalgo about Mauslandia. You talk about that in here. Like, I really did appreciate, and like how you said, like this that has been covered, this kind of fandom. So I appreciated how you really thought about how, like, what this music was drawing from culturally, like how it was drawing from like culturally thinking about what's going on at that time. And it's not just about, so, you know, the fan experience is there, but it's also about this cultural connection. And so one of the things I'd love for you to talk about is like how you define post-punk, because right, you said like you come at this from very different angles, and we can talk about the artists that you discuss through this, but I think like you create a definition for your about post-punk that I think we, you know, needs to be talked about, so that because people look at it differently, right?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Rebecca. Yeah, it's something that I've been taken to task on. A few of the book a few of the reviews of the book that have come out have focused on that and have questioned whether post-punk is the appropriate category to use as opposed to, say, new wave or synth pop or goth or more recent iterations of those categories like shoegaze. I mean the genres and the categories just proliferate over the years. But I was insistent on using post-punk because of the way one that I had become increasingly frustrated at how post-punk was given a very limited time frame, and it was always about identifying particular characteristics of a genre. That I felt didn't fully encapsulate what post-punk could be. And so for me, it was a category that I could kind of open up and think about its overlap with pop music, and then also its deep roots in the history of punk, because a lot of bands on the surface who wouldn't appear to be post-punk according to those more traditional definitions of that genre, like Culture Club, I thought were well, they might play, they might be more pop or pop oriented with respect to their sound. But there's a deep history that accompanies that band that locates them in the history of punk. The drummer John Moss used to be a member of the Clash as well as the Damned. Boy George was kind of part of that scene and talks about going to Sex Pistols and Susie and the Banshees shows and how those were just so formative in terms of constructing his musical as well as personal identity. I think those resistant elements don't always translate just in terms of music, but also the way that certain forms of defiance that were so characteristic of the punk movement trickle into, later pop in the 80s, so that you have, a lot of gender ambiguous figures who I feel like kind of embrace this punk ethos of defiance that goes against, traditional norms. And so for me, it was a way to, kind of expand the category to think of, a temporal moment that comes after punk, but that still has, a connection to punk in some, very undeniable ways. And then also the way that post-punk had been defined a lot of most of the time by predominantly male journalists, it was very male-oriented, and a lot of bands who could qualify as post-punk weren't being identified as such. Like I think the Slits are an interesting example. They're very much punk, but I would also say they're post-punk because of the way that they are experimenting with different musical genres. They're very much indebted to reggae, which was hugely influential for a number of punk musicians. like the Sex Pistols, but you'd be hard pressed to hear that reggae influence as opposed to, say, listening to the Slits album Cut, which is all reggae. And the fact that Island Records, which had been known for releasing reggae music, it was the label that Cut was released on. I just thought, it's very gendered, and I think my embrace of post-punk and my stubbornness to kind of move it away from the way that had been traditionally deployed was precisely about highlighting the elements of gender and sexuality that had been repressed and the journalism that attempted to define it in a very limited way, and drawing attention to very specific bands. And so, yeah, I've caught some heat for that, but it doesn't faze me one bit.
That's good. I was wondering because I have to say that I love the ways, and I love that you are saying that because, or like that expansion of punk, because we so often, I think, especially when people talk about punk, or any term, anything that has to do with punk, it's like, how do we make it really narrow, right? Like punk died and like, it's like, well, punk lasted like a year, or punk is dead, and all of this, and we don't think about expanding it. And so I appreciate how you really looked at like, we need to look at these connections, and we can't just sort of say, okay, it wasn't happening in 1976, so therefore it's not punk, right? So you start with the band that probably, arguably, would be the most sort of punk that people would think of, right? So Susie and the Banshees. And so can you talk a little bit about that chapter? Like why, what about like the wonderful and brilliant Susie Sue, and what you saw with her and what you were doing in that chapter?
Sure. Yeah. So there are lots of different layers, I think, that are that define that chapter. And for me, it was, I mean, Susie had always been someone that I had deeply admired. And as I talk about in the introduction, I was kind of led to Susie and the Banshees by way of The Cure, who had discovered before, with the EP Japanese Whispers and the album The Head on the Door. And it was just by happenstance that I saw the video for Dear Prudence, the song that the Banshees had covered, which was a Beatles song from the White Album, and Robert Smith is in the video, and so I was just really excited to see that. And so, my familiarity with Robert Smith and The Cure kind of opened the door for, discovering the Susie and the Banshees catalog. And soon, I was so much more of a Susie and the Banshees fan as opposed to The Cure. But, I think the admiration of Susie, is, is historic, in the way that she kind of represents this, exemplary figure for women and for queers, and the way that, her defiance is precisely about that, kind of railing against the male dominance of the music scene, the punk music scene in particular, and then the subsequent music scenes that follow in its wake. But it was also about thinking about the different kinds of relationships that she had established with Latino figures, such as Kid Congo Powers, the guitarist, one-time guitarist for the Cramps and the Gun Club, and the friendship that they had cultivated. And when the Cramps and Susie and the Banshees toured the US, Kid takes Susie to Disneyland for the first time, and there are these really great photos that Donna Santisi took of them at Disneyland. And the one that I have reproduced in the book is them riding the rocket ships in Tomorrowland, and I just kind of loved that, that photograph, because of the way that it represented this intimacy between this woman punk icon and this queer Chicano from Southern California, who just kind of, fell into the music scene because of his fandom for these bands that he discovered on a field trip to London with his high school class, and then it was also, kind of thinking about the way that, the Latino fan base in Southern California also gravitated towards Susie, identifying different elements of Latino culture and Susie and the Banshees music. I didn't really talk about this in the chapter, but it's in a footnote. Their song Dia de los Muertos, where Susie sings in Spanish. Just the endless references that I think, kind of note the kind of mutual exchanges that are taking place there. And then I end the chapter by talking about how I'm at this club in Los Angeles, and I happened to bump into Susie and Budgie, and I didn't say anything to her because I didn't want her to, to say something mean and destroy my love for her. And I think that was actually probably a good thing in retrospect. But one thing I will say, it's really interesting, as I've been traveling and talking about the book. I was discussing the book at the Riverside Public Library, and there was a woman in the audience, and she comes up to me afterwards and she says, "I want to thank you for including my photo in your book. I'm Myra, who was the aunt of the young Chicano kid who had won this competition to meet Susie and Budgie when they were touring as the Creatures." And it was just so perfect that, and she was telling me about how Susie was really wonderful and really sweet and talkative. And for me, that was kind of, the answer to what it would have been like to talk to Susie when I bumped into her at that nightclub. So lots of different things that are going on here, but I think it's kind of the best way to really start the book in terms of talking about the different kinds of connections and the way that these various actors come into play, both in the past as well as in the present.
Yeah, and I loved one of the things I loved, and I'm glad you hit on that picture and that image was that like one of the things you talk about is like using A Kiss Across the Ocean and this kind of this touch and how the multiple ways sort of music can physically and emotion can touch you, right? And so I felt that Susie chapter really showed that too, and especially like when you talk about that connection, and I loved I wanted to be at Disneyland when Susie was at Disneyland, right? Like, how can you not want to just be like, that is amazing? But like, yeah, so that is a beautiful, like, that's got to be like, all right, that store, like meeting her, the fan and hearing what she has to say is that's awesome.
Thanks, Rebecca. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So you move from Susie to Adam and the Ants and kind of look at it, who can sometimes there's some con I mean everybody often has controversy with them, but there's some controversy with him. And so can you talk about Adam and the Ants and Adam Ant and how that chapter and sort of what you were doing with that and what you sort of saw with him?
Sure. Yeah, that chapter was difficult to write because of the way that I think what I do is open up a door for kind of a controversial position where, you're drawn to an artist whose politics are questionable, or the music that they produce, kind of is troubling on a number of levels. And so what I tried to do is, both talk about my admiration for Adam and the Ants by way of songs like Prince Charming and just, loving going to see him live, but then also indexing the fact that the Ants released, two songs, which I think were super cringy, Puerto Rican and Juanito the Bandido. I talk about the way that, some journalists at the time, particularly those who were affiliated with Rock Against Racism, called out Adam particularly for the song Puerto Rican, put a beacon to a Puerto Rican, light him on fire. And Adam Ant's response was that it was actually an affirmative representation of Puerto Ricans. But if you read the lyrics, and you don't have to read them too closely, It's kind of, hard to believe that Juanito the Bandido is the same thing. It's kind of like it's bringing up this, very stereotypical image of the Mexican that we see in mid-century Hollywood film. The greaser, or not even mid-century, actually early 20th century representations of Mexicans in cinema. The greaser figure, the approximation to Mexican representation to a character like Speedy Gonzalez, the hypersexualized, uncontrollable, Mexican man who always has sex on the mind. And so, I talk about how I just can't listen to those songs, even though I'm writing about them. And yet I'm still able to kind of embrace other elements of the Adam and the Ants catalog. But I wanted this to, get us to think about, why is it that we're drawn to, various bad object choices, knowing full well, what the historical contexts are of those objects, of those individuals. And yet we still feel something for them. And so I think that this kind of contradictory relationship that we sometimes have with music and music artists, is a conversation that I wanted to have, my admiration for Adamant, on the one hand, and then also my ability to critique, certain elements of the music. But for me, it was also a way to register how, these British kids who are growing up at a particular moment, their introduction to racial difference, oftentimes, outside of the fact that they were growing up with a lot of Caribbean and South Asian youths who had been migrating to the UK, but a lot of their exposure to racial difference was through television and film. And so, of course, they're going to draw on those representations and reproduce them in their lyrics, especially if it's kind of tapping into a certain kind of aesthetic or politics that they're trying to represent. And for Adam Mann, it was all about this overly sexualized, man who is all into S&M and, seduction. And so why not draw on this figure of the hypersexualized Mexican that he could kind of use as part of his, sexually charged image repertoire? And so that's kind of what the chapter is about in a nutshell.
Well, yeah, and like as someone who like these are bands that I grew up with, right? That you start as you get older, you start to see those. So I appreciate that too, that idea that like I can still remember these times and remember these moments with love. And that they help me get through things or help me in certain ways, but look at it critically, right? Like so you don't need to throw it all away. But you can still be critical or of what was going on or what is going on. Yeah.
And it's kind of like what you said before, Rebecca, about, being a huge Smiths fan and a recovering Morrissey fan, and I think, for a lot of us, the Smiths music was so important as a means of survival, especially, as a bullied kid or, someone who's experiencing alienation and, the ability to relate to those lyrics and the music as a form of solace and, the ability for that music to kind of save us, literally and figuratively. And yet, to be aware of Morrissey's politics and his alignment with, the right and anti-immigrant, sentiment, it's like horrible, but, you also want to remember just what that music represented.
Yes. And that's yes. And so like this chapter may often made me think about that, right? That and I could probably talk about Morrissey and the Smiths forever. So but then you so then you move to like darker entries, and I will say I have like, certain well, and the Smiths are one of have one of them, but albums and songs that sort of got me through college, and Peter Murphy's Cut You Up was one. And so you moved to Bauhaus, and so can you talk about Bauhaus and sort of, and you talk a little bit about their other iterations as bands, but what it is about them and what you wanted to get at with what they were doing.
So again, a lot going on in this chapter, I think. And one of the things that I was kind of struck by when reading an article about Bauhaus and what they represented as far as goth culture, and that of course was a category that the band had initially resisted, like Susie and the Banshees, and yet their incorporation into that category was kind of hard to resist because of the way that this subculture that developed would embrace bands like Bauhaus and Susie Sue and Susie and the Banshees. But I was really struck by this one article that said that goth was the one musical form that was untouched by black music. And I was just kind of appalled by that because I remember, not only, as I mentioned before, the influence of reggae on punk, but also the way that a goth anthem like Bela Lugosi's Dead is so indebted to reggae. And in fact, the beat is a dub reggae beat. And so for me, and for me, if you look at if you look at Bauhaus's catalog, I mean, there's so many, obvious nods to reggae. Drummer Kevin Haskins, talks about how, his drumming style was very much influenced by reggae. And so I wanted to tease out that black influence that was kind of undeniable in Bauhaus. But then I also wanted to think about the Latino influences on the band as well as the offshoot projects like Love and Rockets Peter Murphy and Daniel Ash's song Walk This Way, which without realizing it was a riff on the song Oye Cómo Va. And actually had to credit Tito Puente for that song because it was virtually the same song, which then was covered by Carlos Santana. But then also Bauhaus just, has such a huge influence on Latino youth at the moment of their arrival on the scene up to this very moment. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the three of the members of Bauhaus relocated to Southern California. And they're very much part of that scene, and so you hear a lot of these references in their music, as well as in the interviews that they have about what it's like to live in Southern California. And then I was also kind of interested in the way that Bauhaus would kind of surface in the literature by writers like Miriam Gerba, whose story White Girl was about this romantic connection between a white girl and a Latina, and they were both goths, and they would play Bela Lugosi's Dead endlessly. I also talk about David Jay's autobiography this one encounter he has with this Chicana from East LA who's like banging on his hotel door to let her in, and he wonders if he should do it or not. But it's a really interesting encounter that kind of allows me to think about what Bauhaus's music means to Latinas in general. And I talk about the number of friends my sister and other Latinas with whom I'm kind of a fan of the band and their relationship to their music I also just I'm a huge fan of Bauhaus, and so I could not write about them I think that's probably one of my favorite chapters just because it's it just resonates, their music resonates so much with me.
Well, and I just want to say that, reading this, as I said, I keep going down memory lane, but that you this chapter reminded me of this is one band that I kind of absolutely love every iteration of what they did after, right? Like, I am good with Love and Rockets, Tones on Tail. Like, I'm like everything they did, I kind of loved. And so this reminded me of all the ways in which I loved what they did. So thank you for that. Thank you for
Sure.
that little reminder. I'm like, oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. They were in this. Somebody was in this. He was in that. I was like, oh, I forgot.
Yeah. And I should say too that my introduction to Bauhaus came by way of the band Japan, who were kind of like one of the first bands that I just really loved, and I found out about them through Star Hits. There was this a column where people would write in and ask questions to this imaginary I would later find out she wasn't real, but it was just a random staff member's photograph. Suzanne Cologne told me that. And one of the questions was, tell me about Japan. And I had read that they were a huge influence on Duran Duran. And then it was the discovery that Japan bassist Mick Karn had collaborated with Peter Murphy to form the band Dolly's Car, and so that's how I got into Bauhaus.
Is awesome. So, and then you move right, like, and so then you start to look at like Soft Cell, which is a very, I don't know if it's but it's kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, maybe as to Bauhaus, right? A very different sort of stylistically, and yet ties well with what you're talking about. So, can you talk about, you talk a lot about Mark Almond and Soft Cell and sort of what you were trying to do with them and what you kind of saw with them.
Sure. Yeah, I'd always loved Soft Cell. I got Nonstop Erotic Cabaret as one of the 10 albums for a penny through the Columbia Records deal that always gets you in trouble because you have to buy 10 more albums for at the regular price, which is not really the regular price. It's always an inflated price. But in any case, I got that album and it was, kind of an eye-opener. The back cover has it's a photograph of all the adult bookstores and CD cinemas in the Soho district of London, and I was just kind of like really shocked by the song lyrics. I'd been obsessed with Tainted Love because it played everywhere just as it does now. But that album opened the door for me to discover the rest of the Soft Cell catalog. And I was always struck by the song Numbers, and it soon turned out that that was a reference to a novel by John Retchie, who is a Chicano Scottish writer who became known for his first novel, City of Night, and so. So yeah, Numbers was, I mean, and later it became clear to me that that Mark Allman and Dave Ball, but I think Mark Allman more specifically, had been reading John Retchie and Jean Genet and a lot of these writers that I would eventually, come to love. But that was the source of inspiration for a lot of Soft Cell's music. They also did a song called La Escuelita, which is a homage to the Puerto Rican drag bar in New York City. It was so clear to me that Mark Almond had been influenced by queer Latino culture, both as a member of Soft Cell as well as a solo artist. Getting his first collection of poetry, The Angel of Death, in the Adonis Lounge, writing about Puerto Rican go-go boys and these seedy bars and Puerto Rican drag queens, and it was like, wow. So there's this huge influence of queer Latino culture on Soft Cell and Mark Almond's work, and I just kind of wanted to highlight the various kinds of sexual subcultural intimacies that were at the heart of Soft Cell's and Mark Almond's music. And at the center of that was, a queer Latino culture that had an indelible influence on Mark Almond. And for me, that was, just really fascinating to be able to write about, not only in terms of the music, but also the poetry and the lyrics that Mark Almond had started publishing as an author. So yeah, that was also just a really important chapter for me to write, because the way that it is kind of engaging with queerness and sexuality in a very explicit way.
Right. And especially thinking about the late 80s and the early night, even mid to late 80s and early 90s, and what was going on, especially in the United States, right, with very much sort of culture wars and the ways in which we chose to not to or to not talk about sexuality and sexual identity. So I appreciated thinking about that too, and really what some of these artists are doing. That was really, really important. Maybe I don't know if that's even the best word for it at that time, right? Like it,
Yeah,
like what they were doing is really important and something that often they, right, in hind people look at it from the, 2023, 24 and don't think about the risks that were often taken by these artists to just be themselves, right?
And I was always struck by the fact that Mark Almond kind of paved the way for a lot of artists, who and even though he wasn't out at the time, I think the way that he was read, he was kind of out, even if he didn't want to be, the violence that that was provoked as a result of Soft Cell's first appearance on Top of the Pops, with hit all of the, gyrating and the, feminine gestures and the, black eyeliner. And Mark Allman, in his autobiography, Tainted Life, says that it gained him a lot of fans and it gained him a lot of enemies. He started getting love letters from girls and young boys who, after that appearance, ran to the room and started writing love letters. And and I think he did, in many ways, help pave the way for future artists like Bronski Beat and Frankie Goes to Hollywood, as well as Culture Club, and Dead or Alive.
And so you, I don't know if any book about music can be a complete book without sort of looking at fashion and roles of fashion too. And so I love that in between your chapters on Soft Cell and Frankie Goes to Hollywood, you have this piece on looking at, you call it Zoot Suits and Secondhand Knowledge, and looking at Blue Rondo a la Turk. And so can you talk about that too, and sort of also looking at fashion and music?
Yeah. So I'll just say that Blue Rondo a la Turk is kind of the outlier in the book because they're the one band that I didn't listen to as a teenager, and I would later find out about them from Stuart Cosgrove, who is a Scottish writer and journalist. And he told me, how could you not talk about Blue Rondo a la Turk in this book that you're writing? And I'd heard their name but didn't really study them much or look too much into them. But when I did, it was like, wow, this is amazing. They're not only performing Latin music, but they're also wearing zoot suits. And for me, that was just, really fascinating. And it was an opportunity to think about, the zoot suit, and the way that it had traveled, not only within the US, but across the Atlantic and in Britain. And it was adopted by a lot of Jamaican youth who were part of the Windrush generation. Some people have argued, historians have argued, that it was introduced by those youth, by the African American sailors during World War II who were wearing them when they were deployed in Europe. And it was really fascinating to kind of think about the zoot suit in contrast to the rise of the suit in the neo-romantic scene, the way that the suit had become kind of a fashion object of choice by a number of artists, Heaven 17, Bauhaus, Spandau Ballet. Almost everyone wore a suit at the time, but more often than not, it was like an Anthony Price suit, it's a really expensive suit. But the zoot suit was, oftentimes something that one would find in a secondhand store, a charity shop, and it had just kind of resurfaced, and a lot of youth were gravitating towards the zoot suit. And for me, it was really fascinating because Blue Rondo a la Turk, wasn't just kind of adorning the suit just for just as a means of making a fashion statement, but it was also politically charged because they were aware of the history of that suit. And coupled with their desire to perform Latin music, it was just a really important convergence of Latino culture that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. This is also a moment when you have Latin American migration to the UK. And so some of the members of Blue Rondo a la Turk are from Latin America, and they're influencing Christos Tolera, who is Greek, and Chris Sullivan, who is Welsh, who are kind of seen as the front and center members of Blue Rondo a la Turk, but it's these other members as well who are kind of, giving the band their undeniable Latin sound. And along with the zoot suit, it was just a really fascinating history that I wanted to tell. Their most famous song, Me and Mr. Sanchez, a reference to the California writer Thomas Sanchez, who wrote a book called The Zoot Suit Murders. And they had read the book, and the lyrics were inspired by that novelist. And so the influences are both, are not just both fashion based and music oriented, but also literary. And it returned me to the moment when, my entryway into academia was through studying literature and my discovery of these books and my desire to learn more about literature written by Mexican American writers. And it turns out these British kids were also reading the same literature that I was reading.
Which is always awesome. Well, and so then, and you talk about like, and I often I fashion in a different way, but maybe mass culture selling Frankie, right? Frankie goes to Hollywood, and I can't get away with like thinking about them without thinking about like, you know, the Frankie Says shirts and the ways in which, you know, they were sort of sold. So can you talk though about what you saw with Frankie Goes to Hollywood and sort of their relationship to yes, to everything.
I have to say, when I first heard Relax, I totally picked up on the sexual innuendos, and then there's that the sound or that moment in the song where there's like when Holly Johnson says come, and it's like this kind of explosion of water, well, in my mind at the time it was water. I was just really fascinated by that song. And then of course Two Tribes, which became my favorite Frankie song. But for me, they were very defiant and rebellious. And then learning that Holly Johnson and Paul Rutherford were gay, and so explicit about that, it just kind of made their appeal all that more great for me. But I kind of in Two Tribes in particular was really important for me because it arrived at a moment when I was grieving as a teenager, the passing of my great grandmother, who had meant a lot to me. And for me, the song, it reminded me of Freud, the whole idea of the death drive and Eros and the way that he talks about the coupling of those two elements in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, that the subtext of death is life and vice versa. And Two Tribes represented that. It was about the end of the world as the result of nuclear fallout, but it was also a track that was very danceable. And I thought you can have two things at once. You can have mourning, and you can also have, some kind of arousal, luring oneself to pleasure. And they always represented that for me. And I remember hearing Welcome to the Pleasure Dome in its entirety when it was first released, and just kind of, just loving it. And it's not only Relax and Two Tribes, but it's also The Power of Love and the title track Welcome to the Pleasure Dome, and Frisco or Crisco Kisses, and the cover of Do You Know the Way to San Jose. All these tracks, I think, that oftentimes don't get talked about. But also Holly Johnson's solo career once the band split. And I was always struck by the fact that in the song Americanos, Holly Johnson, nods to Chicanos in the US. And he is influenced by this newspaper article that he reads on a trip to his partner to visit his partner's family in Pittsburgh. And it was about Mexican immigration and the way that Mexican immigration had changed, was starting to change the culture of the US. And I was just, really struck by, not only the reference to Chicanos, but also the way that you could kind of link that up to the earlier performances by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and the way that both of those two things meant so much to me as a young gay Mexican American man who had just, loved this music, and it had saved me at two different moments in my, in my early life, in a high as a high school student as well as a college student. And then I also talk about my first time seeing the video for Relax. It was the censored version, and it features the band in a club, in a leather club, and a lot of lewd stuff going on there, and of course it had been banned from television. But yeah, so that was I wanted to write about Frankie because of all of those things, but also because they too are grounded in a history of punk. They're very much tied into the punk movement in Liverpool. And it's always the, areas outside of London that I think don't get enough coverage, because London is kind of seen as the epicenter of punk. But you have these musical movements that are taking place in cities like Manchester, Sheffield, Liverpool, and Liverpool is an important site for the development of this really amazing creativity that's coming out. Echo and the Bunnymen, The Teardrop Explodes, Dead or Alive, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Yeah, and I will say that your story, your little personal piece at the end of this was like my favorite one, because you talk about meeting Holly Johnson and getting him to sign your CD, but like waiting to read what it said. Like, yeah, I was like, I don't know if I could have
Thanks, Rebecca. Yeah,
waited.
that's been really important to me. And I will say, yeah, I'm planning on writing a book on Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. And I've been I'm still in communication with Holly. Sometimes he'll send me some racy memes, and we just have a really great or exchange of ideas. And but yeah, he was really helpful in writing the book. And yeah, thanks for that.
That's wonderful. So you and I, so I will admit, if I were in my office, I would right now show you my Neil Tennant Funko Pop. That Domino Dancing is my all-time favorite song by the Pet Shop Boys. So thank you, because then I had to put it on like repeat and listen to it and remind myself how much I loved it. And then all the things I didn't know about it after, who sang back up and all of that and made it even better. So let's talk Pet Shop Boys. So you
Yes,
kind of
please.
like, because you sort of said this is where you started. So the Pet Shop Boys, let yeah.
I love the Pet Shop Boys, and I think, I said Bauhaus was one of my favorite bands, and Pet Shop Boys is another. For me, it was so clear early on that that they were influenced by Latino culture. It's the Latino version of opportunities, and just the remixes. Early on, they filmed the video for Suburbia in Duarte, California, and it's clearly a working class, Latino neighborhood. But Domino Dancing, yeah, I mean, it was, when I first heard it, I thought immediately, this sounds like expose. And and loved Latin freestyle as a teenager. But when I was growing up, it was kind of like you had to stake your claim and align yourself with a particular music. Otherwise, you weren't, legit. But of course, I had expose's debut album on tape, and I hid it whenever my friends came over. So when I heard Domino Dancing, I was like, wow, these guys are also listening to Exposé. And it turns out they fly to Miami to work with Luis Martinet, who is the was the producer for Exposé's album. And they wanted to produce a song that was a homage to Latin freestyle, and that was the song. And when you look at the video, which was shot in San Juan, Puerto Rico, it's also, clear that there is another level of Latino cultural influence on the Pet Shop Boys. And then also the element of queerness too. People have said that, well, MTV banned the video because they said it was too homoerotically explicit. But when you look at it now, it's like, what? I don't see it. But that was, of course, a different era. As one of my students said, oh yeah, things, changed so significantly. Said, yes, but no. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. But yeah, and you can kind of see the influence of Latino culture on Pet Shop Boys as, as they progress over the years. And the song, or bilingual, their album, which includes Single Bilingual, and a lot of other tracks, Se Habla A, there's a clear Latino influence on their music. And in fact, the single was initially titled our bilingual is initially titled Latino, but they decided to change it. And even up to their most recent song, 30 Something, which was influenced by reggaeton, as Chris Lowe said, the video is shot featuring members of the band Prayers, who is a self-identified Cholo goth band from San Diego. And the video focuses on a formerly incarcerated young man who is released from prison and tries to find a job but can't find anything because he's covered in tattoos and ultimately resorts to slinging drugs again as a means of supporting his kids. So, all of these elements that I was just so fascinated by. And so they became, an important band to write about. I will tell you this, though. I got an email one day, just, out of the blue, and it was this guy who was a museum curator, and he told me that he had discovered my book because I wrote about the book in the LA Times through this platform called Delos. And he picked up the book and he said he immediately contacted Neil Tennant, who's a good friend of his. And Neil responded and said, "I've always been curious about this phenomenon. I just bought the book, and I can't wait to read it." And that just like I died. So I'm so curious to know what Neil thought of the book if he read it. But that for me was, just kind of something I would have never expected.
Oh, I love that so much. And I think that I appreciate all the ways in which you tied them to punk too, right? Like, and punk and thinking about punk culture and the right in this post-punk kind of space and really and throughout thinking about the connections between, I think we often think we had hip hop and we had punk and then they, they're opposite ends of the spectrum, but really thinking about how many of these genres came together and sort of built off one another and learned from one another, right? And pushed in different ways, but also had some ways in which some major connections, right? And so I appreciated how we could see that too.
Thanks, Rebecca. And it kind of goes back to the reggae influence on punk. What I wanted to talk about here is how freestyle really is, part of hip hop culture, but it was kind of pushed away because it wasn't seen as conforming to what hip hop would eventually become, which was also very, masculinist, in the way that it had become rearticulated. And so for me, Pet Shop Boys kind of represent this bridge between hip hop and punk, and there's a quote that I have in there where Neil Tennant says that the early Pet Shop Boys music was almost like punk because of the minimalist quality. And he's absolutely right. And then also his own, personal trajectory, having been a writer for smash hits, and being part of that scene as a young person, growing up in Northern England and then eventually moving to London. So that influence was very much part of the Pet Shop Boys history, although you may not be able to detect it just by listening to the music alone.
And so you conclude this with, you talk about seeing some, throughout you talk about seeing some of these bands, but then you also talk about seeing some bands that, what do I want to say? Like, you see some cover bands. There we go. Right? Like different cover bands and thinking of this and also thinking of how some of this music is now impacting or reaching younger audiences, and as a mother of a 13-year-old who is obsessed with anything 80s, I completely see this right through. Yeah, and I've probably said this a million times, but I will say it again on here. Like, I took her to see The Cure. We drove to Ohio to see The Cure this summer for her first like concert. It was amazing. Duran brought her to see Duran Duran, right? Like, this kind of but I see that like touching a new audience in different ways because of some of that history there. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what do you see? Like, and why is this so important? Why should we be talking about this?
I think one of the things I wanted to do in this book is resist the kind of easy nostalgia that sometimes the 80s come to represent, and harkening back to a different era and seeing how things were in the past. But I wanted to talk about how this music is alive and well, and it doesn't just stop short in the 80s, that it influences people to take up instruments and to form cover bands or tribute bands and pay their respects to the artists that changed their lives. And how in Southern California in particular, and I think it's not just Southern California, but it's also everywhere really, how these tribute bands draw huge audiences because of the way that, if the band no longer exists or, they refuse to play certain songs, these tribute bands kind of pick up the slack and give the audiences what they like, the music that they want to hear. But I'm not so much interested in that as much as I am the way that the tribute band takes shape as a way to kind of touch the artists that influence them and that in turn kind of inspire them to pay tribute to these artists and for this in the service of a fan base of which they're a part. And then also, I talk about going to a specials concert in Anaheim with one of my friends, and when we walked in, I saw a group of young Latino guys who were holding up a banner that said "Ghost Town," and I was just kind of struck by them. They're very stylish, and on that banner also said "Anaheim Against Racism," and so I was just kind of curious to see what they were all about. And it turns out they're a DJ collective who perform at different political functions in Southern California, and very much inspired by the specials and their post I mean, yeah, their politics at the moment, which is all about drawing attention to racial and economic disparity, the lack of jobs, the depressed conditions in which youth are raised in Britain for the specials, and then also for these kids with respect to their citizenship status and their racial and ethnic identities. And they take their name from, of course, the special song "Ghost Town." And for me, it was just an example of the way that this music is so important cross-generationally, that it's not just people in their 50s and 60s who are waxing nostalgic, but it's also a younger generation of people who identify with this music. And it is, kind of a source of not just escapism, but identification with otherness that they don't otherwise have. I see this with my niece who's 14 years old, and she loves Susie Sue, and she loves her rebelliousness and, very assertive and so she likes a lot of contemporary music, but she's also big on the music that my sister and I listened to as teenagers, and it makes perfect sense. And so, yeah, that was the whole point of ending the book on that note, to just talk about how this music, is not just a thing of the past, but it continues to live on, and it materializes in different ways through the formation of the tribute band, as well as in fandom of for younger people who, are just as excited about this music as we were.
So yeah, so I'll ask you my one final question. The book's been out for about a year or so now. Like, what are you working on now? Like, what's the next? What do you want to sort of self-promote?
Well, I said I wanted to. I want to write a book on Frankie Goes to Hollywood's "Welcome to the Pleasure Dome," and I'm gonna take a stab at pitching something for the 33 and a third series. And of course, it's kind of like finding the Wonka golden ticket. It's not a given. You have to be selected. But even if it's not accepted for that series, it's something that I want to write about just because of the my love of that album and the way that I think it just kind of tells us a lot about, our contemporary moment and how it reflects, the politics of the day, not just in the from the 80s, but also right now at this moment. And then also, I think I still have this, point to prove that they weren't just the product of Trevor Horn, but that they were actually, an original band with original ideas prior to his working with them in the studio. that they're a band that we need to take in take note of, and to see as having made a really important impact. I am writing about I'm just finishing this article on the band Los Bacaminos, which is Paul Young's band, which is a group of British musicians who pay their respects to Tex-Mex music. They love Flaco Jimenez and the Texas Tornadoes, and they tour mostly around Europe. Again, I think it's just another example of the way that musical cultures always travel, and that there are so many examples of this transatlantic intimacy that I'm talking about in A Kiss Across the Ocean that didn't get covered in the book.
Well, Ricky Rodriguez, thank you for talking with me for New Books on Popular Culture about A Kiss Across the Ocean. It was a pleasure.
Likewise, Rebecca, thank you so much for having me.